Ready to go? I'm going to I see I got it. We are recording.
All right,
Okay,
sounds
so I'm
good.
going to start with sharing my first screen. Are you going to read the bio? Is that what you're
I
doing here?
actually,
Yeah.
Kevin, I was gonna interject and say that normally as host, I do a couple things before the presenter gets
Okay.
started. So first off, good evening, everyone. It's great to see everybody here for the June 2022 edition of Friday with Friday. Just a couple reminders. I don't think I need to remind anybody here of this, but make sure that the participants tab and that the chat tab are both open so that you can see your name, how you are presenting your name, and everybody else that is here tonight. The chat can be our primary mode for communication during the actual presentation. Outside of that, if you want to edit your name to whatever you want to present yourself as, you are welcome to do so. Feel free to include any nicknames, your initiating chapter, initiation year, and pronouns if you prefer to do so. So, with that in mind, brothers, allow me to introduce Brother Kevin Perrone. Dr. Perrone has enjoyed several different careers in his professional life. Using his talents developed at the Eastman School and Indiana University, where he earned a bachelor's and a master's in music, he spent 12 years performing as a soloist and collaborator in both America and Europe. He then went back to school to broaden his horizons by enrolling in an interdisciplinary program at Texas Tech University, where he earned a PhD in interdisciplinary studies, concentrating in the fine arts and philosophy. He taught piano theory and led seminars in aesthetics at Ball State University, and at the same time, explored the field of counseling psychology. After teaching 7 years, Dr. Perrone enrolled full-time in their counseling program and earned his second master's degree a few years later. He then started his career in school counseling and worked at both private and public schools in New York. He retired from his tenured school counseling position after 14 years. He currently works privately as an education consultant, continues to compose and perform music, and volunteers as an English teacher for refugees living in America. The title of his talk is Critical Thinking: An Open-Eyed Guide to Seeing How the Mind Lies to Us. Brothers, please join me in welcoming Brother Kevin Perrone.
Thank you, David, and thank you all. I appreciate being here tonight, and thank you, David, for hosting this meeting. I'm going to start off immediately with my presentation. Can everybody see this PowerPoint slide here? Yes? Am I getting audio from
Yes,
everyone?
Kevin.
Yeah, okay, we're
We're
getting
good.
quiet. Okay, very good. Okay, thank you. Okay, critical thinking, an open-eyed guide to seeing how the mind lies to us. So I'm going to dive right in here and ask why this title, and even that question, why this title has meaning as far as cognitive biases. Believe it or not, this title itself will demonstrate too many what I call extra rational influences that can affect our judgments. And so by extra rational, I just mean that there are many ways that we think, and we tend to think that don't have anything to do with rational thinking. And rational thinking, of course, has to do with having evidence or weighing empirical data to make decisions. And so if you notice the words I have in red, eyed guide and mind lies, can someone tell me what it is? Why did I make those red? Anyone?
Body parts? They're parts of your body?
Emphasis.
No. Well, they are, but that's not really related to the cognitive bias.
They all have a long I sound in
Thank
them.
you. That's right. Yes, they do. They rhyme. They rhyme. Eyed and guide and mind and lies. And even why this title rhymes, and that's purposeful. There's also a rhythmic flow to the words. And I was going to write out the rhythm, but you can think about it yourself. If I say it in rhythm, it's critical thinking, an open-eyed guide to seeing how the mind lies to us. And that is also purposeful. This title itself uses two cognitive biases, which again are non-rational or extra-rational influences on critical thinking, and it generates the rhyme as reason effect, which actually is caused by two cognitive biases. It's the fluency heuristic and the Keats heuristic. Now, let's just define heuristic as far as the way cognitive psychology thinks of it. If you can imagine hundreds of thousands of years ago when we were either in the jungle or the savannah or in the forest, and we had to make an immediate judgment about whether we should run or hide or climb a tree or try to not get bit by a saber-toothed tiger or get run over by a mastodon or something, our mind developed so that we could make incredibly fast decisions, but they don't need to be accurate. They don't need to be perfect. They don't even need to be rational. They just have to work for that particular moment. So when you think heuristic, we're going to think rule of thumb or an educated guess. But ultimately, it really comes down to the way our mind naturally flows in its thinking process. And so during this whole seminar, I'm going to explore several of these cognitive biases. Now, there's dozens of them. Dozens of them. I think I'm going to go through maybe six or eight. And so this is just scratching the surface, but I kind of pick the ones that I think are interesting to me, and maybe they're interesting to you. So you'll know what they are by the end, and you'll also maybe use your knowledge to mitigate some of their effects. And say, so we're going to talk about this rhyme or reason effect. We actually tend to believe statements that rhyme that rhymed are more accurate. If they rhyme, we think they're more accurate than those that do not rhyme, even if everything else is equal. And that's hard to believe, but there are two reasons for this. One is the fluency heuristic. That means that we can easily remember something. If it's easy to remember, we think it's more valid than something that's not easy to remember. It doesn't matter whether it is more valid or not. That's important. It doesn't matter if it's truthful or not truthful, but if it's easy to remember, we'll think it's more truthful. And that's a natural flow. So here's a really interesting example. I just didn't know about this rhyme, but if I say difficult circumstances sometimes make entities reach consensus, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, okay? But if I say instead woes unites foes, what do you think you're going to remember more? We have three words that rhyme. Well, two of them do. And I can think of a bunch of other examples. If I say, if you eat an apple every day, you probably will not have ever to visit the doctor. But I could also say an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and people believe that. At least they used to. Here's one. Let's say I say something like, well, when you're sober, you can hide things about your personality, but when you get drunk, everything just comes out. I could say it that way, but I could also say, what sobriety conceals, alcohol reveals. People remember that because they think it's truthful. And by the way, that's not necessarily true. Somebody could get drunk and they just know how to cover up their personality. So none of these things are necessarily true. And even that phrase, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, that was actually created when doctors used to visit. That's why the doctor keeps away from your home. They used to go home visiting. So it doesn't even make sense. How about the one, beer than liquor, never sicker. Liquor than beer, never fear. Remember that?
Lies.
That never worked for me. When I used to be drinking a lot in my younger days, I used to drink beer and liquor and then liquor and beer. I didn't care. It didn't make a difference to me. I didn't get sick, you know? Can anybody think of anything else?
Yeah, Kevin, we got a couple of them in the chat.
Oh, good.
So Ryan has contributed stay sober or get pulled over.
Ooh, I love that one.
He's got click it or ticket. This one might be a little bit of a stretch, but one that I contributed from my days of studying chemistry. When you're starting with a strong acid and you need to dilute your acid, what you're supposed to do is add the water to the acid, not the acid to the water. This is to help prevent, you know, if something splashes, then it's water splashing in your eyes and not acid splashing in your eyes. What I was told is, do like you order, add acid to water.
Oh, do like you order. Yeah, that's parsing it, but it's easy to remember. And it's, and right. Luckily, those are truthful, okay?
Indeed.
But not all of them are. Now, here's an example of one that isn't. So this is a little bit visceral, but you may have heard this before. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Right, okay. Now, we remember that, right? You remember that, right? Is it truthful? Absolutely not. I actually talked to a plumber about this. He said, don't do that. He said, actually, the opposite is true, but you should just flush all the time because urine has, well, uric acid besides that, but it also turns to ammonia when it sits, which is very caustic. And it will actually erode the seal underneath your toilet if you leave it in the bowl over time. And so don't do that. You really should flush it. But because that rhymes, people think it's true. And there's a really famous one that I think you'll all remember. Who is that guy that was accused, that football player that was accused of killing his wife?
Orenthal James Simpson.
That's it, Simpson, O.J. Simpson. What did the lawyer use to convince the jury?
If the glove does not fit, you cannot acquit. Oh, must acquit, excuse me.
You must acquit.
Yes, you must acquit, exactly. He said, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. It rhymes wonderfully, right? He knows about this, obviously, and the jury could not forget that when they deliberated. Now, that particular turn of phrase doesn't mean it's truthful, by the way. There were other ways he could have killed his wife, even if the glove did fit. But who cares? It rhymed, so it must mean something, yes? So those are really good examples. And the other one that this rhyme is reason effect takes advantage of is called the Keats heuristic. Information that is aesthetically pleasing is easier to remember than information that is not. So that means that, you know, if it's obviously something that's presented as good form, it's arranged properly, it looks nice, people will remember it and they will think it's more truthful. And the Keats heuristic is named after, of course, John Keats, the poet. The next one is called the framing effect, and that's the way the information is presented may change our view completely. And I've used this many times in my counseling work with clients where someone is suffering from some kind of traumatic event, or they have a problem with the relationship, or there's some kind of situation that they just need some other way to think about it that helps them cope. And that's called reframing in counselor speak. But the framing effect is a cognitive bias that affects everybody. So here's an example. There's a boat that's sinking. There are 600 passengers on the boat. You can save some, but not all of the passengers from drowning. What is a more acceptable result? Okay, you're going to be able to save 200 people from drowning. Yay, that's wonderful, right? Okay. You're going to let 400 people die. So if I say only, you're going to let 400 people die, it's a really different way of looking at that conundrum than saying, wow, you know, you were able to save 200 people. The interesting thing about it is that both statements are true equally. The first is framed where the result's positive, the second is framed where the result's negative. Both framings don't change the result, of course. And this effect actually works both ways, depending on whether you want to emphasize the negative or the positive. Even sometimes putting the positive one first will change the person's perception of how that works. Okay, we're going to move on to the over-optimistic probability bias, which is one that I love because I do this all the time. We tend to think our decisions or actions will affect results more than they might. And this is most obvious with betting and stock picking. So these fellows, Knox and Inkster, by the way, all these are going to be in the references in this PowerPoint here. People were betting on horses. They rated the likelihood of the horse they bet on winning compared to the likelihood of other horses winning that they didn't bet on. So their experiment was, as soon as a person placed a bet, they asked to rate their assessment of the likelihood of their horse, the horse they bet on, winning. So, and what was it? They thought that the horse that they bet on would win by 38% more of a chance than the horse that they didn't bet on. And this is before the race occurred. Now, as you know, placing a bet does not have any effect on the outcome of the race. Nor does buying a stock have any effect on whether or not the company's stock price will increase in the future. Any other examples that we could think of? I wonder.
Yeah, I put one in the chat. I said, as a sports fan, I have superstitions I like to follow so I can make sure my team wins. I can help. If I screw up said like ritual, then they're guaranteed to lose.
And does it work?
It's only stupid if it doesn't work.
Oh, okay. Have you ever done an experiment on yourself and kind of tabulated the times that you've done this compared to the times that you haven't done this and see if there's any difference?
Well, not necessarily, but like I remember the times where I screwed up said thing, like, oh, I didn't wear my lucky socks today. Oh, I lost.
Yeah, I know.
That must be why.
It's a bitch, isn't it? Gotta wear those socks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do this all the time. It's interesting how it's silly, but we all do it. And there's a reason. It's actually a good reason. But we all believe that we'll live longer than the average, that our children will be smarter than the average if we have kids, that we'll be more successful in life than the average person. We believe that. But if that's true for everybody, then everybody's average and it doesn't make any sense, you know? But the optimistic bias actually is good for us, because being optimistic motivates us to pursue goals. And after all, if we didn't believe that we could achieve success, we wouldn't try so hard. But I think this bias, it's really important to dance around or to balance this conundrum where being optimistic increases the belief that good things will happen no matter what, but the opposite side of that coin is that it increases poor decision-making because you're not assessing risk properly. So we have to constantly remember to balance those two things. But as I say, I'm an optimistic type of person, and I'm always on the brighter side of things. And yes, I have made very risky decisions based on that.
Kevin, I do have a question on this subject. Please feel free to let me know if this is not an example of this, but I feel as though most people that when polled about how good a driver they are, just about everybody will tell you that they are a better than average driver. Now, if I know anything about averages, and I know a couple things about averages, about 50% of the population will be above average and about 50% of the population will be below average.
Oh, yeah.
So is everybody believing that they are a better than average driver an example of the over-optimistic probability bias?
It is, exactly. Yes, that's a very good example. It reminds me of George Carlin put it wonderfully.
Yes, I was gonna
remember that. What did he say? He said something like,
About how stupid the average person is.
Yeah.
And then consider that half of all people are stupider than that.
Yeah, that IQ of 100 is average. And half of the people are less than that, which is really alarming. but that's, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey.
As far as driving, I would like to interject on the fact that I don't believe that 50% of people are the average driver. I think the average driver, meaning 90%, are bad ones. So,
Michael, yeah. I feel like you're giving us an example of the over-optimistic probability bias right there.
Oh, yeah. Of course. I never said it wasn't biased. I'm just stating facts according to Michael Lamar Conway.
That's fair.
Yeah, it totally. It's just a product of the way our minds work. And I don't want to be the average driver. See, I want to be so much better. And I have a friend who thinks he's a good driver, and I'm scared to death when I'm in this guy's car. He uses 2 feet, first of all. You know, he puts a foot on the brake and a foot on the gas at the same time, you know? Mm-hmm. And he always drives in the shoulder. Like when he takes a right-hand or left-hand turn, he'll drive in the shoulder. And you know, there's potholes, there's nails, God knows what's in the shoulder, you know? And it's like, I keep telling him, you know, and it's really, but I says optimistic, over-optimistic or inflated probability drivers. He doesn't assess the risk properly. It's a really good example there. All right, we're going to move on. That's what I was saying. It is sometimes good for us. So we don't want to just think that the worst is going to happen all the time. That's not a healthy way of living. All right, let's talk about the gamma's fallacy. And I think, David, you will love this. Now, here's a famous example, one that I just love. So think of it. It's Monte Carlo. It's August 18th, 1913. All right, summer. You got all these incredibly wealthy people before the Depression. So this is like the age of robber barons, you know. And so it's a roulette. It's a very famous, well-documented roulette game. The ball fell in the black 26 times in a row. Okay? Now, the probability of this happening is 1 in 66 million. I did not figure this out. I actually found this out through an article that was... My first source of finding this article about it was on Wikipedia, which was great. They have a great article about the Gamma's fallacy. But then I went to another source, and yes, indeed, it was that. I saw the formula, and Dave, you could probably figure it out yourself, but I couldn't. I had to look for it.
Literally, okay. Just put it into the chat. There are 18 black spaces out of right. 38 spaces on a roulette wheel with 1 through 36 and the 0 and double 0, because American roulette is stupid. But that would be 18 out of 38 to the power of 26. Okay, and I'm grabbing my calculator right now because I always...
Yes, please correct me if I found the wrong information, but I think it's about 166 million. At least that's what they said.
I am doing it right now.
Yeah.
And go ahead and up that 66 million to 274 million.
No kidding.
One in 274 million. It sounds like somebody was probably operating under the assumption that the probability was 1 in 2 rather than 18 in 38.
Oh, that could be. That could be, yes. Yes. So
they assume that it can only be red and black and not the two green spaces that are on there.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, yeah. And it may have something to do. I mean, I'm assuming that was a standard roulette wheel, but you know, who knows? It's 1913, right? But these gamblers lost millions because after, yes, thank you, David. After the, you know, after the eighth black, they were thinking, surely the next one's going to be red. And after
we're due for a red.
Yeah. And after the 12th red, after they lost, you know, $10 million, this one guy said, well, I got to get that back. So now I'm going to bet on red because surely that's next. And he lost it all again. So then the worst thing, you know, putting salt into the wounds is that finally on the 27th time, the ball hit the red. And then they thought, okay, now we're going to get a string of red. Right? Because
that's not that, how randomness works. That's not how any of this works.
I know, but that's what they thought. And so then they lost the rest of their money in the next, you know, 4 or 5 times. So and there was not a streak of red. It was random. So anyway, I have a wonderful history of Monte Carlo gambling in the references. And I'm sure you can think of other examples. Anybody had this experience before? Or
yes, please call on me.
Yes, please.
So this is not my story. This is a story of my office mate, Caroline. We attended Michigan State University together working on our master's degree. There was a combinatorics professor who on the first day of class assigned something to all of her students and said, your homework between now and the next class period is to either flip a coin 100 times and record the outcomes in the order that they take place, or lie to me, say that you flipped a coin 100 times, and then just make up a bunch of random results. This professor was able to tell, from what I understand, 100% of the time, whether the student was flipping the coin or whether the student was lying.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Wow.
So as a quick for example, the probability of getting the exact same outcome 10 times in a row for flipping a coin is 1 in 512. That's 2 × 1/2 raised to the 10th power for the 10 in a row and the two possibilities, either tails all the way through or heads all the way through. The probability of 10 in a row happening when you flip a coin 100 times is almost definite. It's something like 90%. It'll take place 90% of the time.
Mm.
So a lot of them would keep their streaks to maybe like 3 or 4 in a row, thinking that there's no way that it could possibly be more than that. And so that's how the professor was able to point out. No, that's
and you know, that's interesting, because that is one of the cognitive biases I am not talking about tonight, and it's called the law of large numbers.
Law of large numbers is a good one.
And it's a really remarkable cognitive bias where even the most unlikely event could indeed happen if you have a large enough sample size.
If something is 1 in a billion,
yeah,
we have 7 billion people on the earth. The expected value is that would happen to 7 people.
Yes. And so it does. It does happen. And people just, it's really hard to believe it. Which is normal. That's just normal. I think with dice, yes, people think that they've, or with coins, you know, you have 2 or 3 heads in a row and you're going to think, wow, yeah, that's, now the next one's going to be tails, right?
We're due for a different one, just like these gamblers at the Monte Carlo.
Let's look at the availability heuristic. If we can remember something easily, we think that that piece of information is more authentic or truthful than something we cannot remember easily. It's just very similar to the rhyme is reason one, but it comes about a different way. So if we see news stories about shark attacks, we'll think that shark attacks are more common than they really are, even though they are very rare. This is just because we're seeing that. It's just in our memory at the moment. So if we see several news stories about plane crashes, we will think that a plane crashes are, they're more common than they really are, even though they're very rare. And if we see news stories about violent crimes, then we're going to think that a violent crime is more common than it really is, and we'll feel more fearful of a violent crime. And that's especially apropos today, because if you look at the numbers starting from 1970 to today about the level of violent crime in American society, you'll see a graph that only goes downhill. There are blips here and there, but the general direction is that there's a lot less crime than there used to be. Even though if we look at the wrong news outlets, we'll see this crime everywhere, right? And so that's one of those availability heuristic has to do, you know, with the repetitive exposure to the information. And that causes, well, it's the illusory correlation. So we tend to believe two more events are connected if we hear about them at the same time, even if they're unrelated. It's silly that happens, but it does. So here's a wonderful example. This fellow Craig Fox, a really brilliant researcher. So, and Dave, you'll love this, okay? I'd love you to do this experiment yourself, okay? So you have two groups of students, they're evaluating the course at the end of the semester. You ask the first group to write 2 suggestions for the professor to improve the course. And then after they write their 2 suggestions, then they want to write 2 positives about the class. That's the first group. Then, the second group, you tell them you want to have 10 suggestions for the professor to improve the course. And then after they write their 10, then you ask them to write 2 positives about the class. And then we ask the question, who or which group gives the professor a higher rating? And the answer is group 2, which seems incredibly counterintuitive, but here is why. It was more difficult for group two to recall the information they produced. That's the first part, the suggestions. Don't forget now, group two had to give the 10 suggestions. And therefore, they did not remember the negatives as well as group one. Plus, most of the students in group two could not even think of more than two out of the 10. They just couldn't come up with 10 suggestions. And so they had in their mind that, well, I just couldn't think of bad things. And group one rated the course more negatively because they could more easily recall the answers to their more simple previous question because there were only two and they could come up with two. And so there was this availability of the information. And you could read about that research and how it was done in the references. So Dave, there you go. Next time
I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, give it a shot. I mean, you have nothing to lose, you know. I'm sure you always get great recommendations, but it'd be really cool to set it up. Maybe, you know, ideally the research would be to do it in the same class, but give half the students a different form, if possible, you know. I don't know if your school allows that. Sometimes they make the forms themselves, you know.
I do stuff like that all the time. When I give tests, I give a green version and a white version, just calling back to the fact that I went to, you know, Michigan State.
Uh-huh.
So I give two different forms all the time.
Yeah. So you may want to try that. I'd be very curious to see. But read how the experiment was done, because there's some details about the experiment and just how they managed and the forms they used. You can see everything, you know, in the reference. Okay. But it's really interesting. Now, anchoring is one that I really love. Okay, our decision is influenced by an anchoring point, usually a first impression or first data point. So these two fellows, Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, they're very instrumental in the whole business of cognitive biases, and they researched anchoring quite a bit. So, and here's another one that's fascinating. They asked subjects to give an answer to this problem within 5 seconds. Now, they also said, if you can't do it in 5 seconds, no calculator, okay? Then just make an estimate. So because most people could not do this in 5 seconds, the subject estimated, and based on the first few numbers they multiplied, which is, we're gonna call the anchor, they read from right to left, or left to right, 1 × 2 × 3 × 4. And they said that the answer was probably around 512. That was the median of all the participants. Okay, then, this is a brilliant experiment, by the way. They asked the subject to complete within 5 seconds a similar problem. And it's the same thing, it's just the numbers in opposite order. Then they based their answer on the first few numbers of this example. The median, they said, was 2,500. Why did they think it was higher? Well, it's because they just did the first couple of numbers, and then once the 5 seconds were up, that was their anchoring point. So maybe they got to 8 × 7 × 6 and whatever that number is, and they added a few numbers after that, and that's what they got. And yes, indeed, the answer is 40,320. But that shows the power of anchoring. It's really just alarming to see how influential it is. Okay, let's look at this. Merchants use anchoring to compel buying or spend more money. So if you see a higher price next to the item to a lower price, like if you go into a car deal, you see a really expensive car and you see a car right next to it that's less expensive, ostensibly, you're more likely to buy the lower price item than if that more expensive car isn't there. So even if the lower price car is overpriced, because the anchor is your seeing the high price car. And this is something that I just did. I have evidence that web searches do this all the time. It has to do with this. Now check this out. I just searched this yesterday. I searched for men's suits on Lord & Taylor, okay? Or men's jackets. Now look, what's the price of the first one? $250.
Yeah.
What's the price of the second one? $99. Yeah. This is not an accident, okay? Mm-hmm. And the sort is, they say, the sword is by bets match. But they have an algorithm that does this. And by the way, a lot of people do this. You'll see this in airlines or hotels. Well, they'll put a really high priced option first to scare you into thinking, oh my God, this is so expensive. But then you see something that's a lower price and you go for that immediately thinking, I better get this bargain because everything else is so high priced. Meanwhile, the lower price item is outrageously priced if you compare it to something else. So this is anchoring. It's incredibly powerful. Works all the time. In negotiations, business negotiations, even when people are aware of anchoring, they still fall for it. Another interesting, and the mind is so complex sometimes, it's unbelievable that this actually happens like instinctually. So if you see a first offer of $20 and you want to negotiate, you're going to adjust your numbers and whole numbers. But if you see a first offer is $19.95, you're going to negotiate not with whole numbers. You're going to negotiate with the smaller amount, with the cents. And this experiment, which is a brilliant experiment that was done by these two people, that's also in the references. So, yes, I would love to see $2 gas right now. Thank you. So a more specific first price offer will lead to a final price offer that's closer to the first offer. So if you're selling a house and you want to go down to the last digits instead of leaving them zeros, you'll have a better chance of someone offering closer to your price and leaving them zeros. And again, it has to do with heuristics. The brain is always going to go for the closest approximation or the easiest path to find a mediocre solution. That's the path. All right, now we have something that's a little more complicated. So sunk costs, and this is just devastating. So if we've already spent money or time or emotional energy, that's the cost. And that cost is in the past, and it's not necessarily relevant to future decisions. So the fallacy is when we continue with the previous action now or in the future based on our prior action. That's the problem. It's the idea of we're using the past even if it's not relevant to maintain current or future decisions. And people do this, you know, throwing good money after bad. Many professionals do this in many fields. And it is true. It is true with relationships. We invest time and emotion in a relationship, we avoid ending it, even if the relationship is horrible. Because if we feel we've already invested too much time to leave. Meanwhile, you see, we're not thinking about the time that we're spending in the relationship now and in the future. For some reason, that doesn't enter into our minds. I don't know why, but that's the way our minds work. And jobs are the same way, yes. Now, I'm very happy that I don't have this bias with jobs. Because I have quit jobs immediately. I don't care. Because I know, you know, time is short and we don't live forever. So, yes. So, let's look at examples. The Concorde supersonic jet. Does anybody, I don't know, everybody's pretty young here. So, there used to be a supersonic jet you may read about in your history books.
Yeah.
You know, it was a multi-billion dollar, even at that time. The British and French governments paid for it. Completely uneconomical, did not make money. They spent all this money, taxpayer money. They knew from the beginning, after having seen now, we have hindsight to see the documents that these government officials produced. They said, this is never going to work. And they kept doing it. They kept doing it because we already spent $2 billion. You know, we have to continue with this. And of course, that was not the right decision. Here's a hypothetical example. We already spent, okay, water under the bridge. We already spent $20 million on a factory and it cost $30 million to build. We're not done yet. So as we're not done yet, the factory isn't running, so its current production value is zero because it's not doing anything. All right, the 20 million we define as a sunk cost. Now we have to spend obviously another 10 million to complete the factory to get it operational. The other option is that we can abandon our past plans and buy another equally valuable factory for 5 million. Correct decision? All right, the correct decision, let me go back. The correct decision is to obviously lose the $20 million because if we buy the factory for $5 million, we've spent $25 million and we have a factory that's just as good. If we spend the other $10 million, we spend $30 million, so we're down $5 million. That's a tough one. But that's the way it works. And it's a really very common fallacy, and it's generated, the reason why this is so difficult is it's generated by several cognitive biases or lapses of judgment. It has the framing effect is in play here. The plan continuation bias is in fact here. It's feeling that continuing an existing plan is better than changing course without taking into account any empirical evidence. Now there was a very famous oil tanker spill called the Torrey Canyon oil spill, where the captain had a plan and he was supposed to get to the port within a certain time, and he was on his way on time, but there was a weather issue or some kind of problem in the water where there were going to be issues and dangers, and he was told this, but he said, no, we have to do it. I'm not going to change my plans now. We're just going for it. We'll make it. And of course, they did not. And 11% of air crashes are caused by this. It's called, the air people call it press-on-itis, meaning that I'm just going to press on, you know? And I have really good documentation about that in the references if you want to look at it later. But I have a video example, which I think is a lot of fun. This video is from Mission Impossible 4. Did anybody see that movie? Has everybody seen it or...
Not yet.
Not yet? Okay. All right, so I'll give a little background. It's the spies, and what they're trying to do basically is they're trying to stop an evil guy from stealing Russian nuclear launch codes. So the Mission Impossible people, they have a plan. They're going to meet with him. They're impersonating his contact that's supposed to give him these codes. They're impersonating it, and they want to give him fake codes. So that's their plan. But then something happens at the very last minute. And that's all I'm going to tell you for now. What I want to do is I want to switch screens here. I'm going to share a video. Let me stop this share here. We're going to share a nice video here of... I just took a clip. It's a two-minute clip. Oh, wait. No, I'm sorry. You know what I have to do? I learned this about Zoom.
Share your sound as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I got to do the sound. Now, tell me, what is optimize a video clip? Does that work or what? I have a little checkbox there. Does that matter?
I don't think so. As long as we have the audio, I think we're going to be happy with it.
All right. Here we go then. All right. Now, do you see the video screen?
We do.
Yep,
okay.
Seeing it.
Do you see sound?
It's coated with isotopes, which give off a unique...
Okay, good. Okay, here we go then. I'll start from the beginning.
It's in the briefcase. It's coated with isotopes, which give off a unique... It just means that you can track the documents even if they switch briefcases. Range. Not that good. It's like half a mile. Safest thing to do would be not let Wistrom out of your sight. Is that Wistrom?
Who's there with him?
I don't know. We don't have an uplink, so there's no facial recognition.
Who is there with him?
That's Leonid Lysenko, Polish-born cryptographer. He redesigned Russia's nuclear security after the Cold War.
He's here to authenticate the launch codes.
Yes, yes, we are blown.
No, we're not blown.
Well, we will be as soon as he sees the counterfeit launch codes.
We're not blown.
He's in the elevator. Delay them.
Benji, how long would it take you to reprogram the case?
A couple of seconds. Well, what for, though?
To make an exact copy of the launch codes.
What?
Well, you can't do that.
Wistrom's on 22.
Slow him down.
I'll do what I can.
Oh, wait, Ethan, hang on now. Hang on, just a second. You're talking about handing over active nuclear launch codes to Wistrom?
Reprogram the case.
Now, listen, stop, just listen. What you're saying, you're fixated, you're not thinking clearly.
It's not gonna happen.
I won't let it.
33 and climbing. Brand, use your head now. The mission's not the codes, the mission is Hendrix.
Then just let it play out. Give him bad codes, neutralize him.
You know that won't do it. Failure to a terrorist is just a rehearsal for success.
41?
We lose Hendrix today, he shows up somewhere else tomorrow. He finds another way with no IMF to stop him. No, it's now or never. Now, Brandt, give me the case.
Nothing can be left to chance. You said that.
You're the analyst. Now tell me there's not another way for Hendrix to get those codes.
50!
You tell me that this is his only avenue, right here, right now, today. You tell me that, I'll walk away. We go without.
Without masks?
Jane needs to go.
Ethan.
We have no choice.
Ethan, you'd be walking in on Moreau unarmed, face first, literally.
How do we know they've met?
How do we know they haven't?
Doesn't matter. Damn it. I have no choice.
Okay. So what I thought was really, really interesting, let me see if I can point out, and this is what happens, by the way, all the time with this stuff. It's really just terrible how people will, let me see if I could just get a little bit. All right, here we go. I want to go back a little bit where he says, I'm not going to have it. I won't. And then he says, you're not thinking clearly. Remember that? You're fixating. There it is. Here we go.
You're saying you're fixating, you're not thinking clearly.
All right, this is what happens. This is, by the way, what happens when people have cognitive biases. They are sure that the other person is not thinking clearly. So in this clip, what happens is that the fellow is bringing a cryptographer with him, and that's the new thing. This is why the plans change. They were going to give him the fake codes, but ostensibly this cryptographer is going to be able to see that they're fake, and therefore they have to change plans. And of course, Tom Cruise's character, Elliot, has a real talent to avoid this plan-on-itis thing. He can switch immediately and formulate a brand new plan based on the new information. And the other fellow, Brandt, his name is in the movie, obviously the analyst, he can't. He can't do it. He's stuck on the plan. They had a plan. Why can't we stick with the plan? And he's willing to throw the codes out the window. They're in Dubai and the highest building in the world, you know. And so that's something. By the way, this is on Netflix if you ever want to see it. I enjoyed the movie, but I liked that scene. So there's our video example. Let's loss aversion is the other cognitive bias for sunk cost, and over-optimistic probability bias is another. And then confusing the past, the present reality, the future, which is another option. So sunk cost is very powerful. And this is my last one. And when I talked about this last time, but I want to review it again. This is probably, I think, most appropriate to remember for the times we live in. So let's talk about a little definitions. We have in-group, people we believe are similar to us, whether that's by values, race, gender, ethnicities, age, etc. Outgroup, people we believe are not similar to us, okay? How we think of ourselves and our in-group people. So we tend to attribute our success and the success of our in-group members to hard work, personal abilities and talents or other attributes we can control. So that's the important part, can control. And that internal dialogue that we think of is, I am responsible for my own success. That's what we think. And then we tend to attribute our failures to bad luck or external circumstances we cannot control. And the internal dialogue that we tend to think is, I am not responsible for my failures. It's just bad luck. Now, that might not necessarily be terrible because it really kind of conflates with the over-optimistic probability bias a little bit. The problem, though, exists is when we turn around and we think of others in the outgroup, we tend to attribute success of the outgroup people to good luck, special favors, or other attributes they did not control. And the internal dialogue when we see these outgroup people being successful is they are not responsible for their success. They got a lucky break. And then we tend to attribute failures of the outgroup people to a lack of ability, talent, other attributes, or motivation, or self-control. And we think they are responsible for their failures. They are lazy and interested in being successful. It's their fault. And so I think, again, I'm going to emphasize that if we are thinking this for our in-group, why don't we think the same thing for the out-group? Why not? But we don't. It's natural not to. And if we think this, if you see somebody that's not in your group, maybe not your sexuality or not your race or not your whatever, and you see them as not having success in life, it's very easy to say it's their own fault instead of saying, man, there must have been something in that person's biography that they really got a bad break or something didn't go right for them and it wasn't their fault. Because we think about that for ourselves a lot of time. And so ultimately, this is so important to be able, you know, to not succumb to this. And the reason why is that, let me just take a look here. I want to get rid of, yeah, there we go. Is that it? I think that's causing a lot of problems in our society because there's too much polarization. And so people are looking at out-groups and in-groups and they're coming up with these judgments that are false. This is a failure of judgment, by the way. This is completely untrue. If it's hypocritical, if we're going to think of one way about ourselves, we should think the same way about other people, no matter how different they are from us. And does anybody have any comments about this or questions or anything?
I think this is fascinating. For me, as a Catholic Christian, this kind of thinking is the antithesis of the teachings of Christ and his church, from my perspective. Right? There are no outgroups. We're all in this together.
That's fascinating. I'm glad to hear that, actually, because it seems that a lot of people in our world, in American society today, who call themselves religious are having this particular bias.
I couldn't agree more.
And that isn't that ironic?
Ironic is one word for it. I think it's shocking, sad, pathetic, and disgusting.
Yeah. It is. It's very sad and it is disgusting. All those adjectives, I agree with you about that. There's a reason for this. And by the way, you know, when I was getting my psychology degree, we had to come up with our own particular philosophy of counseling, and we could have based it on a whole bunch of different researchers and historic figures in psychology. We can pick one, we could pick many, and one of the fellows that I always was remarkably impressed with, a man named Gordon Allport, and he wrote a book using all kinds of sophisticated research to understand the roots of prejudice. And if you're really into psychology, it's an amazing contribution to humanity, really. And this particular, let me just go forward a little bit here. We're going to talk about the avoidance, but let me just go, yeah. Gordon Allport here, but this particular researcher author talks about the ultimate attribution error, but he uses Allport's cognitive analysis of prejudice as basis, because that he started it. This fellow figured it out way back in the 50s. So how can we avoid these cognitive biases? Now the rhyme and reason effect is easy. Just know that when someone starts rhyming to you or puts things in a kind of a, what can I say? An aphorism, I guess that's the word. Be
or
aware.
Catchphrase.
Yeah, catchphrase. Thank you. Catchphrase.
Childish.
Yeah. This happens a lot in sports broadcasting, graduation speeches, you know. Oh, there's another thing. It doesn't even have to be a rhyme. It could be a turn of phrase. Like one of my friends here told me once that she was having trouble with her dog. And she says, there aren't any bad dogs, just bad owners. And I basically had to tell her, you know, it sounds good. It's got like a parallel structure grammatically, but it's bullshit because that's not true. Some dogs are just bad. They're just born with mental problems. Yeah, they have brain problems too, you know? And I'm not saying that they're bad for that, but it could be unrelated to the owner's behavior. So anytime, I would just be aware of that. Try to be aware. The framing effect, I think the way to avoid that, of course, being aware of it helps a lot, but if someone is offering you a piece of information, it's all about context, and you can change the context. So what if I got this information if it were this way, or in this location, or at this time? And that could help. We talked about the over-optimistic probability bias, the dichotomy between the idea of being healthy mentally and having, you know, keeping away from depression, anxiety, all that stuff. That's important, and optimism helps with that, but also assessing risk properly. So try to balance that. That works. The gambler's fallacy is easy. Every event is separate. Think of it as like there's a gate around each coin toss. There's a barrier around each roulette or whatever you're doing. It's almost like it's its own little world. It's not related to anything before, anything after.
Kevin, we say independent in the industry. All of the events are independent.
Independent, thank you. But I do like the metaphor of thinking of it as if you're like in a garden and there's a gate around you, like a fence. There's a fence. Or if you're in space, you know, you have a shield around you or something. The availability or heuristic, yes, it is true. Hard to avoid because, you know, we just do this naturally. I would be careful in questioning, especially when you're watching news or in the media, when you're seeing things that are repetitive, it might be a good idea to pick up another source and try to figure out really. And if you're feeling, you know, violent crime is an issue, go on the FBI site and see what the statistics are. Or if you think you're going to go for a vacation in the Caribbean and then you're afraid of a shark attack, then go online and see how many shark attacks were there in Aruba in the last year. You can actually see that. It's available. Anchoring is difficult because if we don't know what's happening, it's very hard to avoid. But as I was saying, you know, when I'm on the website and I see like Lord and Taylor's, you know, it's so obvious. When you know what's happening, it's so obvious. And just the other day, I was at the Toyota dealer. I bought a new car like in February, and I was at the Toyota dealer and I had to get an update on the software. And so whatever. So in the showroom, they had this old classic car that wasn't for sale. And the only reason why it was there, it was the anchoring heuristic. It just makes people appreciate it. It's aesthetic. It's a key heuristic as well. It's a whole bunch of things. I don't even know if these guys knew this. They probably have a marketing person in headquarters in Japan saying, put a classic car in your showroom. It'll increase sales. And it probably does. The sunk cost, I think it's a matter of being a little bit mature as we get older and understanding that, you know, the past is the past and let bygones be bygones and don't throw good money after bad and move on. It's easier to do. I think it's been easier for me to do as I've gotten older. And thank you, Gordon Zeft, for your wonderful words about the ultimate attribution error. It's just ethically and morally wrong to maintain that. There's no excuse, by the way. And again, I think that, does anybody have any other ideas for themselves about maybe avoiding these things? Or what you might do, maybe what you might do, or what kind of frame of mind you might put yourself in? Go on.
I feel like a lot of these are focused around spending money, many of them. And so I think it would be difficult to keep all of these in mind all of the time. But I think, for example, if you're going to make a major purchase, you can think about led into that major purchase and what your criteria really should be versus maybe, oh, I saw this, you know, beautiful Corvette on TV and now I want one, or you know what I mean?
Gordon, to that point, when I was shopping for a car about a year ago or so, a good friend of mine reminded me that when it comes to salespeople, make sure that you are buying what you intend to buy, not what they intend to sell you.
Yeah,
definitely. I totally agree with that.
Apologies to any sales reps, but sales reps lie. That's their job, is to sell. And some of them are incredibly difficult to get a straight or honest answer out of.
Yeah.
I wonder how frequently they actually know what the straight or honest answer is.
We have sales reps at my company that don't know what they're selling.
Oh, that's most sales reps. That's why, at least in IT, it's a beautiful thing when you see a sales engineer, as in they actually like were technical with the product before selling it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
As long as you're not getting a commission.
I don't know. The main thing, at least with a lot of these biases, the main thing that I notice, especially going with the idea of like purchasing something, is like the whole idea is to tire you out with decisions that you got to make, right? Like over time, like they'll keep asking, what do you like to do this? Or what do you like to buy this? Like giving you options. So eventually you just get tired of decisions, so you'll just fall into these, like especially anchoring. Oh well, the last thing they asked me for was a lot more expensive. Well, you know what? I'm tired of this. That seems reasonable. I'll just buy it.
Yeah, that could happen, Ryan. That's so true. That could happen. I'll tell you how I got around it when I bought my car. So I went online, and I'm not sure if this is the reason why car dealers have always resisted online buying, because maybe they want to take advantage of these biases when they see you in person. That could be, but I'm not sure. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt and just move on from that. I went online, I picked the car, I picked four options. I picked the mud flaps, the tow bar, the XSE, which is included a whole bunch of stuff, that's the level. And I think there was like one more thing that I picked, and it eludes me now, but it was very simple. And I had a price. Toyota gave me a price. Now, it was interesting that I went to the guy with the printout that I had, and this is in February when everybody was saying, there's no way you're going to be able to buy a new car. All excuses they had, you know, supply chain options, there are no new cars, blah, blah, blah. But I went in October to ask about this, and they said, yeah, it'll take 4 months. And I said, fine, I'll wait 4 months. So he wanted a $100 deposit that was refundable. I gave him $100. But then in January, he texted me. He said, well, you know, we have a car that's ready, but it had all these extra options. And I wrote him back. I said, you know, I really appreciate, you know, I didn't want to tell him, you know, the bad words that I wanted to, but I said, I really appreciate you telling me this, but I'm really just wanting the four options that I ordered. And if you can't get the car for me, then I'll just wait until you can. There was like no negotiation at all. I just said, yes or no. Either give me the car I ordered or no. And he said, fine. It took him a day to get back to me, but he said, fine. And I got the car exactly the way I wanted, for exactly the price I wanted. And I didn't want to do any anchoring. I didn't want to do any kind of other kind of weird, you know, like you were saying, Ryan, about, you know, wearing me down and trying to, you know, just say enough already. I didn't want to meet with the guy that much, frankly. He was a nice guy and everything, but, you know, whatever. You know.
Do you think you could have used some of these against the salesperson?
Excuse me?
Do you think you could have used some of these cognitive biases against use your knowledge of this to use cognitive bias.
I'm not, it's not in my personality, frankly, to be doing this. Yeah, you know, I that's a good question. I just don't go that way naturally as a person to try to manipulate things that way.
Yeah.
But it's a good question though. I think maybe if I can offer this, I think that we may think it may be even safe. This is my cognitive and my psychology perceptions come out. I think it's safer to think that these cognitive biases affect buying and selling things, but they also affect a lot of other things that are maybe more difficult for us to talk about, more personal, having to do with our personal beliefs, our biases, maybe our relationships, maybe our work, our social lives. It all plays into that.
Yeah. Well, here's an example I can think of. If, and again, I probably wouldn't do this either, but like the sunk cost thing, if you have a salesman who's put a lot of time and effort into you, and then you're willing to walk away, which I've always been told you should be willing to walk away, then they might be viewing that time they've spent with you as a sunk cost and be unwilling to let it go, even though realistically you could start the negotiation all over again, right?
Of course. Yeah, there's no guilt, you know, obviously, yeah. And that's, yeah, salesmen are, you know, some are good and some are bad. I had a wonderful experience just not dealing with it. That was my answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I'm telling you, it's the best way for me. I'm not a banterer. I'm not a...
Well, I think, honestly...
Bargainer, you know, whatever, you know.
I don't want to have too big a tangent, but I would say that, again, the over-optimistic probability bias applies to your ability to negotiate, right? I think that's the one that applies.
It can, yes.
Everyone thinks they're a really great negotiator when, of course, you're going out against a professional who does this all the time and you do this once every 4 years. You know what I mean?
Well, if you're going to say, let's say I put it in my point of view, if I were going to say to myself that I'm a better negotiator than any of these guys, I'm going to get the best price better than they think, that's definitely an over-optimistic probability.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I would never say that, though. and that's another thing I think maybe an overarching frame of mind, okay? And there's a framing effect that comes in. If we can frame everything in a little bit of humility, maybe, to say that, well, wait a minute, my mind is not going to work the way I think it's working. There are other paths that it's going to go on that I don't know. I'm not going to be aware of as much as I think I'm going to be aware of. And just to be a little bit more careful about that kind of cocky confidence in these situations. And sometimes you have to be cocky and confident. Like if I were going to go on stage and play a concert, yeah, I've got to have a pot, you know, obviously. So I hope that you all, I'm going to send this thing, but I have some wonderful resources. If you ever have the time to look at some of this stuff, it's really great. And some easy websites, you know, that gives excellent. Here's one with the availability. It happens because I'm watching it, you know. Really just remarkable things that the mind will do naturally that we just can't, we may not even be aware of unless you're familiar with this. And Dave, here's the Craig Fox, the availability is in the classroom house listing where criticism can boost your course ratings. And that's that one. And again, Alport's a brilliant contributor to the whole theory of racism, prejudice, and all that good stuff. So, well, if there aren't any other questions, I think we can finish. Thank you for your attention, and I'm glad that I had a chance to present these ideas tonight.
Were there any other questions, comments, or concerns for Brother Perrone tonight?
No,
great, great topic.
Yes. Well, in that case, let's go ahead and show them some appreciation for a wonderful, wonderful talk. That was great, mind-blowing stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Now, tell me this. Can I put this thing in the chat? Will it the PDF or what?
Are you talking about the actual PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah. Yeah.
So here's what I'd like to propose. First off, Aaron, I think we're good to stop recording at this point.